So when I think about the hallmarks of aging, it's this laundry list of things. So what I did about 10 years ago is I started talking about what I call the seven tenets of aging. And as a cell biologist, I thought if I could organize all of these things into seven piles, it's going to be easier to digest and comprehend. One thing about epigenetics is that you can inherit certain aspects of epigenetics from your grandparents. At the same time, you can change your epigenetics by what you do and what you eat on a daily basis.
Aging expert and author, Dr. Sandra Kaufman.
What you choose to smoke, what you choose to drink, how much exercise, what epigenetic food you elect to consume, all of these will change your epigenetic signature either for the better or for the worse. Generally, a sugar sticks to a glucose under oxidizing conditions and creates something called an AGE. Number one, they're inflammatory and they destroy tissues. This is one of the big reasons that collagen breaks over time. It's a reason that bones become brittle and frail over time. But if mitochondria get damaged, and they get damaged all the time, so unless you take care of your mitochondria, you're kind of toast. Honestly, I cannot understate this, right? It turns out on a molecular level that exercise helps with every tenet of aging. You need a combination of resistance as well as aerobic because different things will do different things to your body. I'm a little bit nuts. I take 70 different agents a day.
If I said that you could only take three supplements out of the 70 that you take, which three would you pick?
I would take...
Hey there, friends. Welcome once again to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew. As always, I'm here every Monday and Thursday to talk all things health, well-being and self-improvement with many of the world's leading experts. And if that is your kind of thing, well, then you're in the right place. If you're returning to the podcast for the 5th, 10th or even 100th time, please show your support by liking, subscribing on whatever platform you're enjoying this content, and sharing with other people who you think might also get value from tuning in. And do leave the podcast a positive rating if you have the time. It'll take you 2 seconds. It is entirely free. And I know you can leave a review on iTunes and on Spotify, be it 3, 4, 5 stars, whatever you think. It'll certainly go a long way to help me reach more people just like yourself. Now, today I'm joined by Dr. Sandra Kaufman. She is the author of The Kaufman Protocol, Why We Age and How to Stop It. Now, this book differs from other books in this field because it barely mentions carbs or ketones at all. Indeed, the emphasis in the book is about maintaining cellular health because, well, in the end, we are made of cells, trillions of them. In this episode, we talk about the mechanics of aging, which Dr. Kaufman has broken down into 7 categories. We talk about epigenetics and how our lifestyle affects epigenetic drift. Find out why it's so important to have healthy mitochondria, especially if you're a woman. Discover some of the major anti-aging molecules that can be taken as supplements. Indeed, Dr. Kaufman takes many of these herself. And I challenge her on this by asking her why a healthy, balanced diet can't fulfill all of our anti-aging needs. We also hear about the role exercise plays in staving off the effects of aging. Now, there is a little bit of science in this episode, but it is worth staying with so as you can inform yourself on the steps that the latest researchers suggest may very well help us live healthier for longer. Let me introduce you, first of all, Dr. Sandra Kaufman, author of The Kaufman Protocol, Why We Age and How to Stop It. Now, your book is different from others in this field in that it barely mentions carbs, it barely mentions ketones, and the emphasis in the book is on maintaining cellular health because, after all, we're made of trillions of cells.
That's spot on. My sort of perspective in all of this is that I was a cell biologist before I went to medical school. I'm a physician now. I'm a practicing anesthesiologist. So my real world is, what do drugs do to cells? What do cells do to drugs? How do drugs interact with each other, et cetera, et cetera? I'm also guessing, I am not a nutritionalist. I am not an exercise physiologist. I believe in good nutrition. I believe in exercising. But I'm not going to harp on those things because, honestly, that's somebody else's turf. Clearly, they are good for you, but I think that those things will get you so far, but in the end, you really have to work on sort of manipulating your cells at the molecular level. And that's where I sort of jump in.
Can we talk about the mechanics of aging? You have distilled this down to 7 different categories, from telomere length to inflammation. Now, everybody, I'm constantly talking about systemic inflammation on this podcast. Can we talk about inflammation, the negative implications of inflammation, and then in the context of these mechanics of aging, the significance of telomere length? Because telomere is a term that many people probably won't be familiar with.
Sure. So of note, people talk about the hallmarks. And when I think about the hallmarks of aging, it's this laundry list of things that sort of gets longer and longer and longer because there's no organization to it. So what I did about 10 years ago is I started talking about what I call the 7 tenets of aging. And as a cell biologist, I thought if I could organize all of these things into 7 piles, it's going to be easier to digest and comprehend. And you mentioned telomeres and you mentioned inflammation, and those fall into 2 different categories. And I think it's funny that people pick out their particular favorites. So those clearly are your 2 favorites. But there are many, many sort of big categories and then subcategories. And if it's okay with you, I'm going to run the list, hopefully not horribly boring in a boring fashion. But we'll get to those things. And see, the idea here is to demonstrate that you age in many, many categories. And when you try to sort of develop your own protocol, you hit the lowest hanging fruit first, and then sort of like move on to the more esoteric stuff, right? So tenet one in my world, I call DNA alterations. So these are things that go awry in your DNA, of course, over time. And there's several of them. So the first thing you mentioned was telomere length. And you are spot on. Telomeres get shorter over time. People get their telomeres measured. That may or may not have actual significance because in every cell, because you have so many chromosomes, you have about 180 different telomeres, right? Because you have 4 hanging off in the end of every chromosome. And all of these lengths are not going to be the same. And of course, from cell to cell and from organ to organ, they're all going to be very different based on what sort of environment or stress that particular cell is under. So cells that have more oxidative stress are going to be shorter than cells that don't, for an example, right? So yes, it's good to have longer telomeres. It's not great to have the longest of telomeres. It's good to have medium length telomeres, and then it's key to not have them shorten as readily, right? So there are various ways of doing this, and we can sort of get into the details later. But yes, telomere length is sort of high on the docket. The second thing under DNA alterations is what I call sort of epigenetics, right? Epigenetics, epi certainly just means on top of. So it means on top of your DNA code. So I like people to sort of picture in their minds the double helix that was described by Watson and Crick so long ago, I think in the 50s. And if you think about DNA methylation, I like to think about little lollipops sort of glued onto that. Or you can think about histone decorations, and histones are what DNA wraps around to sort of control it. And there are about 1,000 different things that you can glue onto or take off of histones. And the whole point of epigenetics is that it controls which pieces and segments of the DNA gets used. Right? Every cell has every piece of DNA, but what's available is dependent on your epigenetics. And the fun thing about epigenetics is that you can inherit certain aspects of epigenetics from your grandparents. At the same time, you can change your epigenetics by what you do and what you eat on a daily basis. So it's a very sort of mobile thing that you can sort of play with to improve your genetic outcomes. So that's kind of cool. And then the last thing in the category of DNA alterations is how your chromosomes are actually bunched together within your nucleus. And they sort of fall apart over the course of time. And we talk about heterochromatin and euchromatin. The abbreviation EU, U means true. And this is the chromatin that you're actually using on a regular basis. And the heterochromatin is the sort of bunched together stuff that you don't use that much. And this changes very dynamically over the course of time, but it changes less and it's far more disorganized as you get older. And this is something that we can sort of help along as well. So those are the 3 big things in DNA. Second tenet is mitochondria. Everyone knows that mitochondria provide energy for the cell. And this fails for probably 6, 7, 8 reasons, depending on how you want to count them, right? Easiest things to think of are NAD deficiency. Easiest thing, by the time you're 40, you are more likely than not to be NAD deficient. And we always talk about how to replete that, right? There's all sorts of different NAD precursors you can take. There's NMN, there's NR, you can do injections, IVs, transdermal, et cetera. And the business is sort of blowing up because everyone knows that NAD is so important. But other things in the mitochondria, right? You undergo significant oxidative stress, and the way you get rid of free radicals sort of takes a dive over time. So you can activate your NRF2 pathways that sort of help that. Your mitochondrial DNA takes a dive over time, and you can sort of fix that. There's something called the mitochondrial transition pore that's supposed to open and close on a regular basis, but as you get older, it's open more than it's closed, and all sorts of toxic stuff in your mitochondria floods out. And the good news is we can control that. The sirtuins that control your mitochondria, 3, 4, and 5, take a dive, and you can help sort of increase the activity of sirtuin 3. So that's quite useful. And there's a variety of handfuls of other things you can do. But in general, mitochondria do fail over time. It's one of the big reasons that women go into menopause, because ovaries use a ton of mitochondria. It's just very energy requiring. So when you're deficient, it doesn't do well for your female anatomy and such. Tenet 3 is what I call pathways. And this is, there are probably hundreds of pathways out there, but the big three that I like to focus on are the sirtuins. There are 7 mammalian sirtuins. By definition, they are histone deacetylases, which basically just means they turn things mostly on, sometimes off, by controlling acetyl groups getting glued on and onto different enzymes. Your sirtuins basically control all cellular homeostasis. So by the time you are 40, you're sirtuin deficient, especially 1, 3, and 6. 1 is general cellular activity, 3 is mitochondria, as I mentioned before, and 6 is actually sits in your chromatin. And as all of these fail, your cellular homeostasis fails. So this is sort of essential. Other pathways, AMP kinase is very important. This is a measurement of how much energy your cell does or does not have. And this is one of the reasons that caloric restriction helps with longevity. So when you're calorically restricted, it signals to your cells that you are lacking energy. And then AMP kinase kicks in and it turns your cell, it sort of puts it in a state of hibernation that helps with longevity. The opposite of AMP kinase is the mTOR pathway. This measures energy as well. But it says, oh, good, I have a lot of energy. I'm going to build a whole lot of stuff. And as you get older, you kind of want to turn your mTOR off versus on, because it really stresses the system. There's a raging war right now about rapamycin. If it's good, if it's bad, how much to take, when to take it, when not to take it, et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole other giant, conversation unto itself. But let's see. Tenet 4 is what I call quality control mechanisms. And this is the idea that if you think of your cell as a factory, right, it makes things. And when a factory sits making things after a while, sometimes it doesn't make it quite as well. Machinery breaks, widgets break, et cetera. So in this category, we have DNA repair mechanisms. We know that every cell, every day, has roughly 10 to the 5th DNA errors. That's a lot, right? So we have significant numbers of DNA repair mechanisms that, of course, fail over time. And as they fail, you are more likely to have dysfunctional cells, senescent cells, and, of course, cancer. You know, everyone's shocked when grandma gets cancer as she gets older, but it's statistically likely. So if we can sort of improve our DNA repair mechanisms, then that likelihood goes down. And we in fact, can do these things. Proteins, which are the widgets that our cells create, also fail over time. So it's a whole system of proteostasis. And it turns out you can upregulate your heat shock proteins and upregulate your chaperones and all of these various things to make proteins more stable, or getting rid of the bad ones easier, right? Also in this category, I put the idea of autophagy, because autophagy is truly just recycling of pieces and parts that have gone bad, right? So that's sort of in the quality control division. Then we get to the 5th tenet, which now you're going to like this, because this is the idea of your immune system and your inflammatory system. Because, of course, your immune system is very helpful when you're young. As you get older, you're chronically in a state of inflammation. And it comes from various things. It comes from senescent cells. It comes from fat cytokines. It comes from, just many, many, many places. And of course, if you don't take on your inflammatory system, inflammation causes cancer because it causes DNA damage, et cetera, et cetera. So you're just not going to do very well if you are chronically inflamed. Tenet 6, I call individual cell requirements. This is the idea that a senescent cell you want to get rid of, and we have ways to do that, versus a stem cell that you want to nurse to perfect health as much as possible. And it's also the recognition that a bone cell is different than a brain cell, which is different than a red cell, and they all have their individual cell requirements. And then lastly on this list is what I call waste management, right? If you don't take out the trash, your factory is not going to go well. And in this category, I talk generally about glycation. Glucose and other oxidizing or reducing sugars are extremely harmful to the body. They like to stick to things. Generally, a sugar sticks to a glucose under oxidizing conditions and creates something called an AGE, which is an advanced glycation end product. And these things, number one, they're inflammatory, which adds to the other category we talked about, and they destroy tissues. This is one of the big reasons that collagen breaks over time. It's a reason that bones become brittle and frail over time. And then lastly in this category is something called lipofusion, which is just cellular gunk. When a cell sort of undergoes autophagy and it recycles its pieces and parts, there's always a bit of gunk in the back that it doesn't know what to do with. So it just shoves it in the back of the cell and ignores it. I like to think of this as like the kitchen drawer phenomenon, because we all have a drawer somewhere in our kitchen where you throw the crap you don't know what to do with, right? And the longer you've lived there, the fuller your drawer is. And at some point, you can't open it and it's useless. We all have it, right? That is lipofusion. There's no way to get rid of it, and we're just stuck with it. But if you reduce the amount of stuff that you put into the drawer, that's how you sort of combat that problem. So in a very long soliloquy, that's why you age.
What a great answer. Arguably the most comprehensive answer I think I've ever had on this podcast, and I've been doing it for 4 years. So I know that's terrific. I didn't expect you to go through all seven, but thank you for doing so. And I suppose lying at the heart then of your book, The Kaufman Protocol, is a scale whereby you score each category as far as its anti-aging efficacy is concerned. So could you talk to us about that?
Sure. Sure. So once I decided that you aged in seven tenets, right, it became this mind-boggling complexity of what did what and how well it did it and what evidence we had. So this whole thing started out years ago. I had a big chart on my desk with, big giant boxes and whatever. I had the seven tenets at the top, and I started going through all of the agents that people said were helpful for longevity. I'm like, well, why are they helpful? You know, whenever I asked anyone, the classic answer, I love this answer, is my grandmother's uncle's aunt's brother told me it was good for me, right? I'm sure we've all heard this. Like the worst answer ever. So I decided to figure out what each agent did in each of the seven tenets. And it started out as just checks and minuses or question marks. And then it turned to, oh, that one's really good, check, check. And then it turned to, ooh, even more evidence, check, check, check. And at some point I thought, you know, I need to sort of make this more sort of a solid scientific efficacy scale. So what I did is if agent X had proved to be efficacious in cell culture, test tubes, or in theory, it got a one. If it proved efficacious in any models that were not human, so mostly rodents, sometimes chickens, sometimes pheasants, sometimes horses, mostly rodents, and there was solid evidence, it got a two. And if there was good evidence in humans, it would get a three, which meant that, oh, and if it did nothing, it got a zero, obviously. Every agent that I rate comes with a barcode, right? A 0 to 3 scale in each of the seven categories. So people see like 0.3.2.1.2. Et cetera, et cetera. And the idea here is that you can now line up the agents that you have chosen, make a grid for yourself, and add up the numbers. And you can tell if you have 17 points in one category and zero in another, maybe your approach to longevity isn't a balanced one, right? The other thing it does is it says, well, if I have some concomitant medical problem, let's say arthritis or diabetes, or my family has a propensity to cancer, you can put extra points in the categories that contribute to that disease process. So the numbers make it a lot easier to, number one, remember what does what, but two, to create a really effective personalized protocol.
Let's dig into a term that you mentioned already, epigenetics, and in particular, a term I hadn't encountered before, and that is epigenetic drift, and how our behaviors and lifestyle influences this drift for good and for bad.
Yeah, so epigenetic drift is really interesting. And this, visually, if you're looking for an example, this is why identical twins look less and less alike over the course of time as they get older, right? theoretically, they should look the same if they were exactly the same with the same epigenetic modifications, right? Because they're born with an epigenetic signature, which is identical. However, what you choose to do in your existence, what you choose to smoke, what you choose to drink, how much exercise, what epigenetic food you elect to consume, all of these will change your epigenetic signature either for the better or for the worse. And thus your genotype gets changed into your phenotype. And by this, I mean like what's written in your code becomes what we see, right? So it just drifts from what one would expect from normal, you know? And there's everyone's really funny. People are like, oh, smoking pot can't be that bad for me, does it? Well, yeah, you know, people don't realize that they are changing their epigenetic signature. All of the bad stuff does it. Cocaine does it. Heroin does it. Pot does it. Cupcakes and Twinkies do it, right? Everything that your grandmother said you probably shouldn't do has a negative genetic or epigenetic effect. At the same time, you can go on a positive epigenetic diet. So for example, there's lots of foods that are very, very good for you epigenetically. Green tea is fantastic. Sulforaphane from broccoli is amazing. Resveratrol is a fantastic epigenetic modifier. And we know by definition that these affect the enzymes. They either take things on or off of your histones and or DNA to control your epigenetics.
What role does metabolism play in the aging process? Because again and again, I'm hearing terms, I think you mentioned a couple already, like mTOR, sirtuins, AMPK. These keep cropping up in this discussion.
So metabolism is a word that's really hard to describe, right? Some people think of metabolism as how fast can I eat through calories? Other people think of it as how many carbs can I eat, or I can eat this, but I can't eat that versus, oh, I exercise, blah, blah, blah. Truly, when you're talking about metabolism, it's how does energy flow through your body? I mean, like at the very basic root. And your body and everyone's metabolism is going to be a little bit different, again, based on genetics and environment. But in general, you have things that measure the energy flow through your body and respond accordingly. Right? That sirtuins are perfect examples. It will regulate how your cells respond to energy, assuming your sirtuins are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Unfortunately, by the time you're in your 40s and 50s, they don't do what you're supposed to be doing. I mean, I'm sure you've heard it a million times. Someone, you know, hits 45 and says, you know, I eat the same, I exercise the same, I do everything the same, but now I'm 20 pounds heavier. Why is that? Because you're sirtuin deficient. Your sirtuins determine what energy source you're going to use. Determines, am I going to use glucose? Am I going to burn fat? That's all sirtuin deficient. So if your homeostatic mechanisms are failing and you don't fix them, you're sort of hosed in the long term. I mean, that's not a very medical thing to say, but it's what it is, right? At the same way, specifically, energy is measured by AMP kinase. If it's low, it does one thing. If it's high, it does another. As you get older, your AMP kinase enzyme does not respond just because it doesn't. So we take things to artificially affect our AMP kinase levels.
You mentioned it earlier, and it's a term that people will find straight away whenever they Google aging or anti-aging research. And that's the term rapamycin. You said it's a bit of a minefield at the moment. Where do you sit in that argument about rapamycin and its anti-aging effects?
So interesting. So rapamycin, what it does, well, so mTOR. mTOR is a pathway, and they call it the pathway of youth. So it's a serine threonine kinase. It measures energy, and it builds things. So it forces cells to be active and to build. And it mostly affects cells that are fast turnover, right? So muscle. You need your mTOR to build muscle. You need your mTOR to build new memories. You need your mTOR to do a lot of things. Right. Unfortunately, as you get older and you're forcing cells to do things that they physically can't, you can cause certain pathologies to occur. High blood pressure, for example, some people blame mTOR on. It's forcing cells to do things they can't do it. They release horrible cytokines. You end up just with hypertrophy of various cell layers in the wall of your vessel. Get high blood pressure and cause platelet overactivation, which causes them to be oversticky. Then you're hypocoagulable, might precipitate a stroke. So studies in animals have demonstrated that if you block mTOR to a certain degree, you're going to age much better, right? So the problem is if you block mTOR completely, you're blocking cell turnover that we all need. So for example, if you know, having muscle is important to you, you can't block your mTOR because you're going to become sarcopenic. And we know that if you're old and frail and you're sarcopenic, you're more likely to fall down and break something, right? So you kind of want to block it, but you kind of don't want to block it all at the same time, right? And not just muscle, it's memory too. The hippocampal area in your brain has massive cell turnover and activity, and that's how you make new memories. So if you were to block mTOR completely, you're not going to make any memories. And you know, my running joke is I'll live forever, but I won't remember it, right? That's kind of not so great. So everyone thinks, and everyone's sort of in agreement, that you need to partially block mTOR, not entirely. How do we do it? Rapamycin is the sort of standard thing to do it. And everyone knows small doses, some period of time. Right now, I think the growing recommendation is 3 to 5 milligrams, like 1 day a week or something of that nature. There are a lot of variables that go into this because there's two receptors. There's TORCH1 and TORCH2. People are working on different RAPL logs. I think right now we don't have the answer. I'm sort of in the anti-rapamycin category right now. I'm old, but I'm not that old. I need my muscles for physical activity. I want my memory intact. So I'm not taking any rapamycin. I will use it topically on my skin because I don't think it goes systemically. And there are things that can sort of partially inactivate mTOR. So because AMP kinase and mTOR are sort of on a seesaw, if you will, if you activate AMP kinase, you're sort of semi-deactivating mTOR, right? So metformin is a good example. It's an AMP kinase activator. Therefore, it is a partial mTOR deactivator. So by going with partial deactivation, I think we win until we actually have RAPL logs that can differentiate the two receptor types and figure out exactly what the optimal timing is going to be. So I don't recommend that anyone jump on the immediate rapamycin bandwagon unless they've really thought it out.
How do mitochondria become damaged or dysfunctional, and why should we care if they do?
Oh, gosh. Because mitochondria are life. Gosh. Mitochondria, So as an example, if your mitochondria decide they're going to die, they take their cell with it. Well, let's back up. What are mitochondria? They obviously provide all of the energy to your cell, but they also do so many other things. They control your calcium metabolism. They control fission and fusion of themselves. They control communication to the nucleus. They do a heck of a lot more than people actually think that they do. Some people like to say, like the running joke is how many mitochondria per cell. Some people will be like, oh, 5 or 10 or 5,000 or, you know, whatever. Some people say, oh, no, it's one because they're all theoretically connected. There's a huge process whereby they join together and separate apart. It's called fission and fusion. And this sort of responds to the energy needs of the cell and to the environment to which it is in. If you're energy deficient, you'll have fewer. As you sort of have too much energy, then you have fewer. There's like a sweet spot in the middle where you have just the right amount responding to exactly what you need. Assuming all is going well, you're great. But if mitochondria get damaged, and they get damaged all the time, oxidative stress causes damage, glycation stress causes damage, mitochondrial DNA stress causes damage. When they start to not work so well, what happens is the membrane on the inside that creates energy, where it houses the electron transport chain, that sort of falls apart. When the energy drops, then it can't control the electron transport system nor the pores. If the pores open, cytochrome C escapes, and that's sort of like toxic waste pouring out of your mitochondria into the rest of your cell, and it becomes apoptotic and dies. So unless you take care of your mitochondria, you're kind of toast.
Which is not.
I know that sounds like horrible, but it's true. And people always say, like, you know, I'm a little bit nuts. I take 70 different agents a day. And I know there are people crazier than, you know, they take 100, 110. But what I do, I've maxed out, I think it's 70. But I take small doses of many things with the idea is that they're all positively synergistic so that I can, for example, take care of my mitochondria in 8 different ways without sort of forcing them to become reliant upon certain sort of divergent pathways, right? Because if you fix all of the different things a little bit, it's going to be positively synergistic.
Okay. You've introduced your supplementation there earlier than I was going to broach the subject, but let me ask you about it now. Just from an evolutionary standpoint, Does it not make sense to get all of the nutrition and all of those components that we need from our diet exclusively rather than from supplementation? Or is supplementation enhancing what we're getting from our diet even further?
So naturalists are going to say everything will come from your diet, right? Yeah. Well, naturalists also have to admit that people never really lived that long before, right? If we got everything from what we needed, what, are we going to live forever? That's it's just not going to work that way. Our bodies are designed, and I shouldn't say designed because that suggests that someone designed us, but our bodies act, right, such that we procreate, we have children, we raise them, and then there's no or very little evolutionary pressure for us to live that long. In fact, it's the opposite. If we're old and dying, we're sort of a drag on society, right? So these are just, the system is just the way that it is. If we could get everything we needed from the perfect diet, people would be living forever. There would be no disease, right? We would have figured it out by now, but we haven't. And the reason is that your diet cannot possibly give you everything that you need, right? Great example. Blueberries are amazing for you, right? Blueberries contain a molecule, it's a stilbene called pterostilbene. It's related to resveratrol. It's a very strong activator of SIRT2-in-1, right? If you ate enough blueberries to activate your SIRT2-in-1, you'd be eating 3 gallons of blueberries a day, right? So yeah, you can get it, but you'd die of blueberry toxicity. Actually, you wouldn't. You would just, you know, be like the chick from Willy Wonka. You'd turn into a giant blueberry. And you just can't do that with every agent that you need, right? And the easiest one is NAD. We all know that you're NAD deficient by the time you're 40, 45. Why is that? It's simple. You have more DNA damage as you age. You need NAD to fix DNA issues. You need NAD as a coenzyme for your sirtuins. You need NAD to communicate from your mitochondria to your nucleus. You need NAD to run your electron transport chain. You just don't have enough NAD, and your requirements go up as you age. So by definition, you become deficient. And we absolutely know that if you augment that, you just do better.
In the book, you have a great acronym. If you could run through it for me, Panacea. Could you tell us the significance of each of the letters in Panacea?
So the Panacea is sort of funny. So what happened is the book now, that the first book has been out by about 5 years. So it's a little dated. The facts are still the facts, but now there are more facts to add in, which is why I wrote book 2, and now I'm working on book 3. But at the time, I went through all of the agents that people sort of said, you know what, they're pretty good for longevity. And of course, I asked the same question I asked before. Well, why, right? And then, you know, people would sort of come to me, hey, what should I take? And inevitably, people said, you know what, I can take 5 things and then I'm done. So I had to create a pile of 5 things that I thought were the most efficacious, cost-effective, and agreeable to people at the time. So the list was this jumble of 5 things. And it was a jumble of 5 things. And a friend of mine's like, yeah, you can't tell people to take a jumble of things. That makes no sense at all. So I sat there playing with the letters, and inevitably they rearranged themselves into sort of spelling Panacea. Like, not entirely, but it was close enough. I'm like, all right, good enough. So Panacea stands for, the P is pterostilbene. This, as I talked about before, is the thing that comes from blueberries, because it's very, very important that you activate your sirtuins. You can either take pterostilbene or resveratrol. There are sort of pros and cons to either, but as long as you're on one of them, you do pretty well in terms of sirtuin activation. PA is astaxanthin. Our free radicals build up over the course of time, and the best free radical scavenger that comes from nature, I think, is something called astaxanthin. Comes from algae. When algae, like you'd find like the gunk in a bird bath, gets angry at you, it turns into this cell with like orangish, pinkish slime. And this is sort of infiltrated the marine environment. So anything that you see are pink or orange is filled with astaxanthin. So PA is astaxanthin. So N is some sort of NAD precursor. As we said before, right, everyone is NAD deficient. So having a precursor is very important. So let's see, that's PAN. System breaks down a little bit there. There are 2 Cs. So curcumin is one of the strongest natural anti-inflammatories that we have. The caveat to this is that if you just take turmeric, which holds curcumin. It's not good enough because there's not that much in it. It's only 1% to 5%. And natural curcumin, the half-life is very, very short. It'll be in your body for about an hour. So that, too, is not all that great. The good news for us as consumers is that there is an escalating scientific project to sort of see how much more bioavailable we can make curcumin. And right now, I think the wonder is something called metacurcumin, packaged in a nanomycel, which makes it about 200, 300 times more efficacious or bioavailable than the other kinds. But if people want to buy curcumin, all I ask is that they read the bottle and it says like highly bioavailable, because there's going to be lots of formulations out there. And then the last C on this pile is carnosine. And this is a naturally acting dipeptide. We all have it in our bodies. As you get older, you have less and less, and men have more than women. So by the time you're an older lady, you're sort of deficient. Carnosine is important because it is a transglycosylating agent. So all of the glucose that starts accumulating in your body is you can actually get rid of some of it via the transglycosylators. And this is the easiest and the cheapest, so it got thrown in there. So the panacea is pterostilbene, astaxanthin, an NAD precursor, curcumin, and carnosine. So that's what the panacea is.
These are all anti-aging molecules. Speaking of which, I was doing a little bit of reading, and taurine has been mentioned as in the same category. Where do you stand on taurine supplementation?
Oh, I love taurine. Taurine is extremely useful for your mitochondria. It's fabulous. I take it. Lots of people take it. Weightlifters, bodybuilders tend to take it. Oh, it's fantastic.
What I've discovered in recent weeks through doing multiple interviews with various different medical professionals is that the mitochondria are just so vital to absolutely everything. It's an organelle that is really underappreciated by people, I think.
Oh, no, without a doubt. So when I sort of created my seven tenets, and that's why it's like number two on the list, because number one has to be the nucleus, right? The brains of the operation. Without a nucleus, you're just nothing. But tenet two is mitochondria. It is absolutely crucial for your mitochondrial health, you know? And I give entire lectures on how to optimize your mitochondria step by step by step, looking at the electron transport chain, looking at the pores, looking at the lipids that actually hold the electron transport chain, you know, looking at the mitochondrial DNA, because that's really just interesting all by itself. Because our regular cellular DNA, of course, has ends, which is why it has telomeres, right? Mitochondrial DNA didn't come from us. It came from a cell that became us billions of years ago. So it's inherited differently. It doesn't have telomeres, and it doesn't have histones, but it still has an organizational process. It's very, very small, but it's key. And over the course of time, it does get damaged, and you do have DNA repair mechanisms in your mitochondria. And it's just extraordinarily interesting the smaller and smaller you get into the details. But without a doubt, you caught it. Mitochondria are crucial.
You mentioned earlier that you take 70 different supplements per day. People will be wondering, how do you take these? Are they in tablet form? Are they in liquid form? Are they in form of a patch? And then do you take them over the course of the day or just once a day?
Good question. So everyone has their own way of doing things. I can't stand shakes or liquids that taste terrible. I just can't do it. So everything I take is generally in a pill form. I've divided. So as an anesthesiologist, this is where I get to have fun with medicine, right? There's lipid-soluble, there's water-soluble agents, and then you have to think about the half-life of agents. So for example, if I'm worried about free radical scavenging, I will take a lipid-soluble free radical scavenger in the morning, and then I take a water-soluble free radical scavenger in the late afternoon, because they're roughly 8 hours apart, and that's roughly what the half-lives of these things are, generally speaking, for most drugs. So the idea is to cover as many different cellular compartments over the longest period of time that you have. So I have a morning stash of about 25 pills. I have a mid-morning stash of about 10 pharmaceuticals. And then somewhere late in the afternoon, I do the rest of the non-pharmaceuticals. So I've got three piles.
You're fond of piles. Definitely. You seem to categorize things in order to, I suppose, simplify the process, because it can't be easy ingesting, what, 70 supplements a day?
Well, you don't want to think about it every day, right? So it's just I decided at one point that this was what it was going to be. This pile's there, and it I don't have to think about it anymore, right? Now it's just a habit.
You are physically active, though. I know you rock climb. How important is physical activity, particularly as you get older, in order to stave off the negative effects of getting older?
Oh, I honestly cannot understate this, right? This is the one thing that I can't cheat. It turns out on a molecular level that exercise helps with every tenet of aging. Every tenet of aging. You need a combination of resistance as well as aerobic, because different things will do different things to your body. No one has to be like, you know, the super uber duper athlete. You don't need Olympic strength for this, but you have to be active. And the longer that you are active, the longer you will be able to be active. It increases the blood supply to tissues. It increases the nutrient supply to tissues. It's amazing. And, you know, as an anesthesiologist, I see people from all walks of life coming in. I will tell you that the people that actively sort of take advantage of this through their lives, you know, like there was a 65-year-old guy today comes in and he's completely healthy. You know, he broke his arm skiing. Great. On the other hand, there's a 40-year-old who's 400 pounds, diabetes, hypertensive, you know, the whole nine yards. The difference in exercising versus not, it's just overwhelming. Overwhelming.
We mentioned the supplements already. If I had to pin you down, if I said that you could only take three supplements and out of the 70 that you take, which three would you pick?
I would take astaxanthin, curcumin, and NAD.
Because these are the most fundamental and the most efficacious as far as anti-aging is concerned.
I mean, I think there are. I mean, obviously, I mean, there's so many that are so powerful. Spermidine is powerful. Fisetin is powerful. I could live without them, but I wouldn't want to live without them, which is why I ended up with such a big pile. But it's funny, when I go on vacation, I have to play favorites. I can't take all of them all the time. So, but those three are absolutely, I couldn't live without them.
It's a fascinating book. Let me give the name of it again. The Kaufman Protocol, Why We Age and How to Stop It. Dr. Sandra Kaufman, great to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time today.
Oh, my pleasure. And the only thing I will tell your listeners is that the book is not as hard to read as they think it's going to be. It is science, but it also has a lot of really bad jokes in it and some strange asides. For example, in book two, I go on this like whole tangent on Jell-O shots, which is utterly ridiculous, but I find it moderately entertaining. So like, there's something for everyone will be in these books. It's just not hardcore, boring science.
I forgot to ask you as well, if people want to reach out to you and find out more about you, where can they go?
So the website is just kaufmanprotocol.com. The website has my email address at the bottom, so that's super easy. As well, on Instagram, I am Kaufman Anti-Aging. And I will tell you that either myself or my 17-year-old daughter helps me answer stuff. Other than that, I have no help. So when I get to stuff, I get to it. Otherwise, just please be patient, because there's no accessory staff.
Well, thank you so much again for your time today, Dr. Sandra Kaufman.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you enjoyed it, if you got any value at all from this episode, or indeed any of the previous almost 400 episodes, show your support. It'll cost you nothing, but makes all the difference my end. Like, subscribe on whatever platform you're tuning in. Share with other people who you think might also get some value, information, and education from these episodes. And do leave the podcast a positive rating. Until next time, stay happy.